What's king supposed to be like? How are they supposed to behave? What are they supposed to do, not do? What are they supposed to love? And so there will be moments where, right, it's almost as though the narrator steps aside and we're hearing Deuteronomy again. And we'll encounter that later, especially. But even now, it would be worth rereading that section of Deuteronomy a few times just to keep that in our minds as we're trying to assess what's going on, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy, what should we think about certain people's actions. Just keep that passage in Deuteronomy in mind. So, do we want to just go ahead and reread that right quick? How about it? Give people a couple more minutes to get here. So we'll reread Deuteronomy 17 before jumping into 2 Samuel 4. The first half of the chapter is dealing with forbidden forms of worship, which is not unrelated to the actions of the kings, especially as we'll see later in the book of Kings. And then together with that, how do priests and judges decide cases? Which again also relates to the role of a king. But the specific directions for king come in verse 14 and following. When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreign over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So bear that in mind as we reflect on David here in this portion of Samuel. So 2 Samuel 4, a recap of where we've been, right? Saul's reign has come to an end. David has is now out from under the Philistines. He's been invited by Judah to come and be their king and has been anointed. He's been in continuing tense relationships with the house of Saul, who continues to rule over Israel. Joab has just murdered Abner, who is Ishbosheth's commander. Despite there being tension between Ishbosheth and Abner, I doubt Ishbosheth is going to be excited about that. And that does leave us still wondering, okay, what is going to happen? Is David going to become king over a united Israel? And if so, when? And what role will the house of Saul continue to play in Israel's politics? In the midst of that, right, we had an Amalekite come and bring news to David of Saul's death, thinking that he was, you know, going to get a reward, because this is definitely the thing that David most wants to hear, right? And that's not the reward he got. And that interaction is very much in the background as we approach chapter 4. So let's read that together. 2 Samuel chapter 4. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Baana, and the name of the other Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin, from Be'eroth. For Be'eroth is counted part of Benjamin. The Be'erothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Now the sons of Rimmon, the Be'erothite, Rechab and Baana, set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ishbosheth, as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. When they came into the house, as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night, and brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and on his offspring." But David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Be'erothite, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And David commanded his young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. All right. First reactions, things that stood out, questions you have. Rose? Righteous man. Those are both good questions. I think the first question around, right, David calls Ishbosheth a righteous man. Does he really think he's a righteous man? I mean, especially someone whose name means son of shame, right? I think that this is not a remark about the entirety of Ishbosheth's character. This is more a remark about the relationship between David and Ishbosheth. David has no grievance against Ishbosheth, right? Ishbosheth is the one in line for the throne when Saul died. He's not come by the throne of Israel by unrighteous means. And so in that sense, although there's certainly a great deal of political tension between David and Ishbosheth, it's not as though Ishbosheth has wronged David and this somehow makes it right. So that in that sense, the relationship between Ishbosheth and David is righteous. There's no mark on Ishbosheth's public character that somehow justifies this wicked act. Does that make sense? They say that. And that's a good point, right? So they say, let's see, where is that? Verse 8, verse 9. "Here's the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy who sought your life." I think that "who sought your life" is about Saul and not about Ishbosheth. But that does, right, what they say does give the impression that there's this enmity from Saul that continues with Saul's house. But if we look at what the narrator has demonstrated for us so far, that doesn't seem to hold water, even with the action of Abner, right, continually trying to disengage from military action with Joab, right? So that even in what they say, there's still the implication of a hostility between Ishbosheth and David, and they've somehow done David a favor in putting down the Lord's enemies and his enemy in doing this. And David, in his reaction, completely disowns their act and refers to Ishbosheth as a righteous man. And in that, I think there are a couple of things going on. One is the recognition that there's nothing in the relationship between Ishbosheth and David that would justify what they've done. And there's also nothing in Ishbosheth's public character that would justify this either. So that they are shown to be brigands and bandits and murderers in their action. Does that make sense? And the head, I don't know. I don't know why they don't reunite the head with the body. Perhaps, they've come very quickly, but it's still, I doubt they kept the head on ice. So I'm sure things have begun to decay. So as great as it would be for the body and the head to be reunited, I think there's also perhaps a couple of things going on. One is that the best care for the body is to go ahead and bury the head straight away. But it also perhaps may serve as something of a political bargaining tool, because now David has Ishbosheth's head, which his family may want back. I don't know. That's not something the narrator develops, if it is part of why. It would seem to be something that they do to honor Ishbosheth in taking proper care of the part of his body that they have. Welcome. We're in 2 Samuel 4. So we've just read about Ishbosheth being murdered and a fellow bringing the news to him, thinking it's good news. And that's not how David responds. So, Ron.
Why does David respond this way physically, this way, and not that way?
What differences do you see? Because that's important, right? We've got three murders that have occurred in the last few chapters. Three reports, right? And one is the Amalekite bringing the report of Saul's death and describing himself contra the narrator, right? Describing himself as having had a hand in it. We have Joab's murder of Abner, right? And then we have this murder of Ishbosheth as well. Two, very clearly, not done by David's hand or under David's orders, and to which David responds in a particular way, right? Killing the messenger. But the one in the middle is perpetrated by David's lieutenant, right? So from the outside, as you're looking at what happened, it could potentially be tallied to David, as David did this. So his response, on the one hand, has the other aspects of this very public, almost over-the-top denial of what's been done. But you're right, that does raise the huge question mark about the difference in character in the rest of David's actions, like the consequences for the murderer. Because Joab doesn't catch what these other fellows get when the news comes to David. Now, Joab also doesn't walk in and tell David, guess what I did? And it was for you, right? He doesn't even try that. So there's that difference as well. But it does put the difference there. In a much starker light, and casts even more of a shadow over David's inability to handle Joab. So, it does, yeah. Although even there, as we mentioned last week, right, the reasons Joab offers, and then the things the narrator explains about why Joab did what he did are in tension, right? Which does not speak well of Joab. Watch for that, right? That is a particular device that the narrator will use, where the narrator will describe something and then we'll have a character describe something. And sometimes they'll match. Sometimes they'll mismatch in ways such that a character is giving us more information. We're finding out later something the narrator had not revealed to us earlier. But other times it will be because a character's lying. Right? Or a character is attempting to deceive or conceal. Right? And that typically does not speak well of a character. So shadows cast over Joab and over Joab's relationship with David, and especially bookended by David's handling of these other two murders, a long shadow cast over the relationship with David and Joab and David's ability to rein him in. Yes. So we've talked specifically about how Deuteronomy 17 with the law of the king is in the background as we kind of watch David and ask, does he line up against the standard or not? But in the background of this whole history, right, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, is the book of Deuteronomy. The whole book of Deuteronomy. Let's talk about that for a minute. So, some scholars have looked at this history from Joshua to the end of Kings and said, really, it seems like the theology of Deuteronomy underlies this whole history in a way that Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers don't. And so they've constructed this idea of what they call a Deuteronomistic history, where we have Deuteronomy, and that's the foundation, and then we have this history that's been written on the basis of Deuteronomy. So far, so good. Right? Some of them will further suggest that the writing of Deuteronomy is divorced from the writing of the rest of the Pentateuch, and that this is a later history. And that may or may not be the case, right? But at the kernel of what's there is a really important and really helpful observation that makes sense in light of how the Bible presents Israel's history. Right? Deuteronomy is a giving again of the law given at Sinai for the generation that's about to enter the promised land. It's not a different law, right? It's the longest sermon ever preached, right? Most of it is in quotation marks. This is Moses as an old man getting up and introducing and delivering and explaining and applying the law to the generation whose parents died in the wilderness right before they enter the promised land. So it makes sense then that Deuteronomy's presentation and explanation of the law would be the leading framework for that generation and those that follow to assess their own history, right? So Scripture helps us understand Scripture, right? And later writers assume that we've read earlier writers, and earlier writers make more sense in light of later happenings, but particularly helpful for understanding Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings is a detailed knowledge of Deuteronomy, right? Deuteronomy, the Pentateuch gets a rap for being boring. It's not. Part of why we feel it's boring is because we read it slowly. Right? Because we'll start a Bible reading plan that has us reading in four or five places at a time. Right? So we get right? We get Exodus a chapter at a time. And at the beginning, that's okay, right? And then we read about the crossing of the Red Sea, and that's exciting. And then we read about the law for the Passover, which is not as interesting, especially when you're only reading a chapter of it, right? And you're reading Matthew at the same time, right? But if you read it quickly and slowly, right, the place that Bible reading plans go to die is the end of Exodus. Especially because when you look beyond Exodus, you know that you're looking toward a book whose name is Numbers. Right? You've got Leviticus, where you read about houses that can have leprosy. Right? And then you get a whole book called Numbers. Right? And so you get to the second half of Exodus, and you break it down. You've got all the instructions for the tabernacle, which go into great detail about scarlet twisted yarn, right, and fine linen, and a bell of pomegranate. And you have a Bible reading plan that has you read that a chapter at a time. You're like, oh, please. Okay. Done. And then you get the golden calf. It's like, oh, some drama. This is interesting. This is intense. This is bad news. And then that's followed by them carrying out the instructions for the building of the tabernacle for several chapters. And we feel like we just read this, right? But what's going on is beautiful, right? Because in those instructions for building the tabernacle, think about holidays with family, right? Maybe you always had Thanksgiving at grandma's house. And so you can actually close your eyes and walk through grandma's house in your mind. And you can describe what you smell. You can hear the voices of your family members. You can see the way the table is set. And think about the richness and the beauty of that memory. That's what's given us in the description of the instructions for the tabernacle, is all of that glory and beauty in all of its detail. And I would recommend actually reading that second half of Exodus in one sitting. Right? Pour yourself a big cup of coffee and just dive in and see that glory and beauty, and then read about the golden calf, which is the moment where all of that suddenly is going to never come to pass. Right? Because if God is just, this ends everything. And the Exodus is for nothing, and there is no promised land, and this is the end of redemptive history right here at the base of Mount Sinai. But it's not. It's not. And so them carrying out the instructions for building the tabernacle is a celebration of God's mercy. Every twisting of linen, every lintel, every tenon in the posts for the screen is a joyful realization that God's mercy has overcome our sin. And then it ends, right, with God's holiness, His presence filling the completed tabernacle. Right? If we read it at a chapter at a time, I think we miss some of that. Right? All of that's a long aside, right? The Pentateuch's not boring. Sometimes we set ourselves up to find it boring, right? Read Scripture in large chunks, right? Big chunks at a time. And that will help dispel some of that, even if that means you have to toss out your Bible reading plan. Honestly, though, if your Bible reading plan is hindering your Bible reading, then get rid of it. Get rid of it. So a reading of Deuteronomy will help us as we read Samuel. It's always in the background. And I forget why I went on to that point. Because of Joab. It helps us understand the nature of what Joab did, right? Because there are laws and there are guidelines set up for what do you do when a family member has been killed. Because the family wants justice. But not every time somebody dies has there been a murder. So what can the family do to avenge their family member who's been killed? What can the one who has caused the death do to preserve his own life if harm was not intended? Right? It's the law of the kinsman redeemer, right? And the blood avenger. And so if we read that and we compare what has happened, right? Abner should not have been killed. Right? So, long story short, read Deuteronomy. It will help us as we read Samuel. So, and reread, like, give Exodus another chance. Right? And Numbers. My goodness, Numbers. Right? It's a census at the beginning and a census at the end. And then the story of what happened in between. In the wilderness is a much better title. And that's what they call it in Hebrew. We should just call it In the Wilderness. We'd be far more interested in reading it. Okay, but we're in 2 Samuel, chapter 4. Other reactions. We've had some good questions. I got something I'm curious about, but I don't know if I'll raise it if you guys don't. I'm sorry, I was taking a drink right as you asked. It does, yeah. Like, that's really weird. Because we get one long verse about it in the middle of everything. It's verse 4. Because we'll hear about Mephibosheth later. But hearing about Mephibosheth here does seem quite odd. I don't know. Obviously, right? It was just, this was all things that were all over the cutting room floor that they were picking up and pasting together, and the editor was asleep at the wheel here, and it just happened to be stuck between the wrong pieces of papyrus. Because the narrator never does anything like that on purpose. It might be simply to leave us scratching our head and wondering, okay, Ishbosheth is murdered here, but that's not the end of the house of Saul. We already know it's not the end of the house of Saul because David got his wife back in the previous chapter. But by slipping that in here, we also know that in doing this dirty deed that these men do, they have still not gotten rid of all the male heirs of Saul's house. Although by being lame, we may see him as not fit to be king. Maybe. Maybe not. Rich.
The part where David says about Saul's family, doesn't he invite Mephibosheth into his house to care for him?
He will. I believe that's after. I believe this is our first. Yeah.
This idea that, okay, hey, we still have some remnant of Saul's family, and then later it sets up this beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll see that in chapter 9. So that's a few chapters down the road. But it does bring up a covenant that David made with Jonathan. That we're wondering if David is going to be able to fulfill. And perhaps that is why Mephibosheth is mentioned here.
So it's a little bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah. It's a cliffhanger in a couple of respects, right? One is, by the way, this is not the end of the house of Saul. And also, by the way, because it's not the end of the house of Saul, David's not off the hook for the covenant he made with Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. So it's also, David's in a very delicate situation politically. That's not part of what the narrator is highlighting for us. There are some commentators who, like, they make that the main thing that they talk about, and we've argued against them in a couple of places in earlier chapters, right? Based on the one time we glimpse David's private thoughts, they seem to match his public conduct in that way. So David is not merely a political animal, but he is still in a very delicate political position, right? Israel's already afraid. The narrator tells us that because of Abner's death. They have every reason to suspect that despite David's public conduct, he had a hand in that. It cripples Israel militarily. And so David is not just in the position of commitments to the house of Saul, and in particular to the house of Jonathan, but he's also needing to bring Israel in peacefully and not allow himself to be presented in the light of winning the throne over Israel by unrighteous conquest. So, what's up with the mutilation of the bodies of these young men? Their hands and feet are cut off. That's weird. We don't do that. Not even with criminals. Right? Why would they do that? I think it's something the Philistines do. I don't remember if it's something the Israelites have done. I think even more broadly, it's just a further way of disowning their deeds. Right? The things that they've done with their hands, we have no part of. We'll cut their hands off. Right? And the feet along with it. So, I think it's a way of giving them a dishonorable death and a dishonorable punishment that shows that to the house of Judah, their deeds are inexcusable. So, just a further disowning of what they've done. Yeah. It might be. We also, right, got a biblical basis for a siesta in the midst of that, right? Because Ish-bosheth took a rest in the afternoon. Although we also got an example of what can happen to you when you do that. So we can read that both ways, right? This is either it's biblical to take a nap in the afternoon, right? Or don't take a nap in the afternoon. Look what could happen to you. So... Right? He was a righteous man. He took a nap in the afternoon, right? Whereas these men, right, they didn't get enough sleep. They came all through the night to bring this to David. So.
Just
to
be clear, it's cool to take a nap.
Just lock your door first, right?
Right.
Yes, so these seem to be people who work for him. So we've seen, right, there's another angle to this, and that's that things are falling apart politically for Ish-bosheth, right? His suspicion of Abner had already led Abner to make overtures to David, to bring Israel over to David. Abner's gone, so Israel's afraid, Ish-bosheth's afraid, and now others rising from the ranks of Ish-bosheth's own military infrastructure are the ones who perpetrate this deed. So, yes. Yeah, I do think that's an important detail, though. That Saul's son had two men, verse 2. Like, these were people he knew. These were people who worked for him. These were part of his military elite. There's so much here. Should we go into chapter 5? Let's do it. I don't think we can do all of chapter 5, but we can get a taste for chapter 5 and come back to it next week. Everything's going to get better now, right? We've said that, I think, at the end of every chapter for the last 6 or 7 chapters. Everything's going to get better in the next chapter. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, 'You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off,' thinking, 'David cannot come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And David said on that day, 'Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul. Therefore it is said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house.' And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built the city all around, from the millow inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons who built David a house. And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. And these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammuah, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Yafia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand.' And David came to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, 'The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood.' Therefore the name of that place is called Baal Perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, 'You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines.' And David did as the Lord commanded him, and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer." Things are better, aren't they? Although, if we've got Deuteronomy 17 in mind, there is possibly an ominous note in the midst of the chapter. Right? Israel comes. Israel anoints him king. He has a long reign. He takes a city to establish himself a new capital. Right? These are all elements of what makes for a powerful transition of power in the ancient Near East. Right? There's an assembly of the nation. There's the establishing of a new capital. There's the taking of new wives. that go with the new reign. There's international relations, right? There's prosperity and peace in the nation. There's military success against the Philistines. And most of the reports of these things are attended with inquiring the Lord, or, right, the Lord has done this, or the Lord has blessed him. But there's a piece of it where there's no note like that at all. Did you guys notice where that came? Well, the end of that paragraph, as much as that offends our sensibilities, I think that's more about the Jebusites and their remark than it is about David. And that paragraph ends, right, with David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. That is somewhat ominous. That is somewhat ominous. Although that could be viewed as just a pillaging of the Philistines and a demonstrating that their gods have no power, that they're able to be carried off. That is a good question. It is somewhat ominous that the idols are carried off by David and his men rather than destroyed. He takes more wives and concubines, right? Which is nothing more than what you would expect of any ancient Near Eastern monarch. But there's no note about the Lord's blessing anywhere around that. Where in several other places throughout the chapter, there are. And if we're thinking about Deuteronomy 17 in the back of our minds, right? And about what we've read already, right? We already know David has six wives, and he's gotten back a seventh, who's actually his first wife. And that does leave us wondering, as we read Deuteronomy 17, who's not supposed to multiply wives? Well, like, is two okay, but three's not? Is five okay, but six is across the line, right? But we already know he has six, he's got a seventh back, and now he's further multiplying concubines and wives. And we don't even get a number, but we get plural for both concubines and wives, right? So he's got to be up to at least 11 at this point, right? I reckon anybody reading Deuteronomy 17 in any context is going to say that's pushing the, you know, how many wives constitutes multiplying, right? Especially if it's more than two on the concubines and wives. And that is something that is specifically flagged in Deuteronomy 17 is also, interestingly, the only kind of action in the chapter that seems to be completely without the Lord's blessing or an assumption of the Lord's blessing. And I do think, right, especially because in the midst of that we get, although he's not singled out, we get a son of Bathsheba. And we'll read about later. So I do think, although it's subtle, there is something quite ominous about that mention in the midst of the chapter. So.
I wonder if in Deuteronomy 17 says,
That's an excellent point. Deuteronomy 17 specifically points out you shall not put a foreigner over you. But some of David's wives, even ones earlier mentioned, specifically come from royal houses of neighboring nations, which would mean an heir from that union would not be holy from among their brothers. That's a good question. That is. Which is perhaps part of why Solomon is chosen among all the various possibilities. Oh my, we'll come to that. Yes. Oh. Yeah, I don't know if we'll just continue into Kings indefinitely after we end 2 Samuel, but I think it's definitely worth reading the first few chapters of Kings. It's so interesting, the situation in which we find David and Bathsheba and several people gathered around a frail, old David, who does seem to be able to rouse himself at one point, but only for a fleeting moment. So, but we'll come to that in time, maybe. Okay. The idols are going to be made of precious materials. So carrying them off does not necessarily mean then installing them in their houses, right? So, but that's a good point. Sometimes we can check Chronicles to see. Chronicles is written for a different audience, for a different purpose. But very much worth reading. That's another one that we tend to skip, right? So, yeah. But 1 Chronicles 14, you said, is the parallel chapter. 14, verse 12. All right. Well, thanks for joining us on this first Sunday of Daylight Savings Time. Let's go get some coffee.